are back again, and it does have I forgot to hit the right button, didn't I? Yeah, I did it again. Oh, well, we'll hit it now. There we go. I hope you enjoyed the previous couple of hours talking, and being a vet, I was supposed to be here, but naturally I missed it. Well, I turned on my radio and went, oh my goodness, I'm supposed to be down there. And then I heard how many people were here, so I kind of slowed down and I got here, but I did not talk. Anyway, I talked enough yesterday about my service in the Vietnam era. And as all of you know, today is Veterans Day. And I'm going to talk just generally about, I do have a lot of interesting military facts that we'll be talking about, things that you don't know, you don't hear about the military, and we're going to talk about that. I also have a couple of Vietnam, well, not Vietnam, but military oral histories things from an open site that allows anybody to go in and listen to them, and they're very interesting. And I'm going to play that for you. I think one of them's about 15 minutes long. I don't remember what the other one is, but we'll talk about veterans and things about Veterans Day and what's going on today. Well, I really don't have anything about what's going on today, but I hope you can honor a vet. And I'm not saying that for myself because I'm a vet. Like I told you yesterday, I'm a United States Army Field Band Vietnam era vet, which meant that I didn't have any active service in Vietnam. We did have some, excuse me, just one second here. I'm getting a signal from my, here we go. I got it back. I was told by a great friend of mine from Athens who was a Vietnam vet who had spent a long time in the service in Vietnam. And he told me, we all had a job to do. You did what you were supposed to do. The fact that I was a vet meant I took a job that had an MOS for it and they needed to fill. So I always appreciated when he would say that. We did, as Vietnam vets down in Athens, we did a really neat annual mountain bike race. I think it went on for about 8 or 9 years, and it was really successful. In the heyday, I think we got about 250 bicyclists, and they were mountain bikes, and they raced through Hocking Hills, or not Hocking Hills, Hocking Valley, it's the national park down there, or the national wilderness or national forest or whatever it's called. And it was behind Hocking College, and raised a lot of money for the Vietnam era, or for the Veterans Association down there, and also the VFW. And we were pretty proud of that. I think it has ended, but that's a hard job to do, and you know, it requires a lot of volunteers. So, as does this banner program. I'm glad I listened to it. Somebody told me that they saw my picture, my mug, already on the internet. We did an ad for the banner thing. There were five of us, I believe, all from media in the surrounding area, and we all encouraged people to support their vets and also get in touch with the people that are creating this banner. And maybe if you have somebody that you'd like to honor, living or dead, it would be a neat thing to do. I'm thinking about getting one for myself, but it sounds a little self-serving. You get one for yourself, and I'll guarantee you know what I think. I love my wife, but I guarantee you she would not want me to post my picture up anywhere. She knows I would like it, but she also doesn't like the attention that it brings to the family. Well, anyway, one of the things that I remember about being a Vietnam era vet, when I came when we appeared in public and the Army Field Band was in public, I don't know, probably twice a week for the 2 years that I was as a member of the Soldiers Chorus, at least twice a week and sometimes every day of the week, depending on whether we were on tour. We toured all over the world. Well, not all over the world. We did North and Central and South America. We did not go to Europe, I don't believe. No, we did not. And but we had a lot of people would come out to our shows, and this was at the height of Vietnam, 68, 69, 70. I believe Vietnam ended in 73. And I had been told by other veterans that it actually started way back in the early 60s, if not touching on the 50s. Now, back then, the French were involved and everything. But we had people that would come to our concerts with placards that told us, make love, not war, or make music, not war, or, you know, implying that we wanted to go kill people. Now, that was the you know what it was. That was what they were implying, that we wanted to do that. It was our duty to do what we were told to do. Now, if it was an illegal order, it was also your duty, not to do it. But, and I'm talked about the William Calley trial yesterday, the My Lai massacre thing, and there were many people that were convicted of, well, not many, but there were some people that were convicted of following those illegal orders as sent down by Lieutenant Calley. None of them served anything, including Lieutenant Calley. He ended up, he got a life sentence. It got dropped down to 20 years, then dropped down to 10, and then dropped down to 3, and then it was dropped to home confinement for 3, and then President Nixon, I don't think he pardoned him, but he said that he was taking the charge off of him. So anyway, that was one of the stories, and that left a very bad taste in an awful lot of people's mouths. On that side, on the other side, Jane Fonda went over to Vietnam and kind of supported. I have a lot of friends that will tell me I'm wrong, but I don't believe she was supporting the Viet Cong. I think she was supporting mankind. And I have friends that won't even mention her name to this day. I believe she thought she was doing the right thing, and it may have gotten twisted or turned or something like that. And it ended up being a kind of a black mark on her life and career. However, I think she's done a good job of trying to help the people of the world in the years since then. I do remember people coming back, and like I said, people threw stones at us. People called us baby killers. If you were in uniform, no matter what you did, you know, nobody knew that I was singing in the United States Army Field Band. They just saw me in uniform, and I would have people. I don't recall anybody ever spitting on me, but I do recall people calling me obnoxious names and telling me that I had to get out of the country and things like that and go back to Vietnam and get killed and, you know, that sort of thing. Well, I hadn't been to Vietnam, so it was kind of interesting that they would say something like that. The thing that always bothered me about being a vet was that I had fellow vets from World War II and also vets from the Korean War that never got much notice. Most of the World War II vets were welcomed home. They were loved when they came home. There were celebrations and things like that. But then people forgot about them, and I always felt that badly about that. That people forgot about what those people had done. Now, to touch on that, most of them didn't talk about it. It was either too traumatic or something they wanted to forget, but most of them didn't talk about it. I had one friend who had what they call PTSD right now. We called it, back in those days, they called it shell shock. And he was a World War II vet. He went to my dad's church, and everybody thought he was a little odd. Well, that's what World War II had done to him. He wasn't odd before that. I knew his wife very well, and they were married before he went off to the war. And he was nothing like he was when he came back. He was a very odd gentleman. Most of the people in my dad's church wouldn't allow their kids to talk to him. They were afraid that that was his problem. You know what I mean? And it was not his problem. He was just befuddled, and we called it shell shock, and it was PTSD. And but that kind of bothered me, that people couldn't understand that he had served, and he had kept them from having to face the Japanese or face the Germans or, you know, the Italians. He was a good man. He fought hard and paid the price. And so I always felt bad about the World War II vets. I didn't know any World War I vets, but the most forgotten vet, I think, must be the Korean War vet. I was looking for interviews with Korean War vets that I could play today. I could not find any. I'm sure they're there. I just, you know, I'm not that good on the on the internet, but one of the ones I'm going to play for you, I believe, is a Vietnam era vet, and he has about a 15-minute story, and we're going to probably start that here in about 5 minutes, so that you can listen to his story, and it's on a website, and I'll tell you after the fact, I'll tell you what the organization that makes these available to you, and you can go to YouTube and listen to these, and there are dozens of them, dozens of oral history presentations from World War II, from, I think there are probably some from World War I even, and all the way up through the wars in the Middle East, and they're very, most of them are not terribly graphic, but they kind of give you a touch of the feel that the men and women in service had when they were serving for you. And today is that day that we honor that. And I thought it was interesting this morning I was listening, and they were saying it is not a day like Memorial Day where we honor the dead. This is a day where we honor the veteran. Dead or alive, and it should be a joyous day. Happy that they're home, happy that they're safe, or happy that we knew them, that type of thing. And so I hope you do that. And for the young men and women who have gone off to fight in the sands of the Middle East, we owe them a debt of gratitude as well. Some of the things that have happened have become so politicized, I'm not going to get into it, but if a person is going to serve in the military, I think you should at least acknowledge that they were doing what they thought was right. I don't think I knew anybody. Now, there were people that went into the military because it was a way to get out of going to jail. But that doesn't, if they were a bad apple, they didn't stay in the military very long. But I knew two or three of them in my basic training group that had been sent to basic training in lieu of going to jail. And they were wonderful guys. I think most of them were from the Chicago area because that was where my basic training unit really came from. They were all really great guys. I told you the story yesterday about Klarsky. Klarsky was probably the only person that I have anything negative to say about, and it's really not negative. It's just kind of humorous the way Klarsky was. And matter of fact, I should be very grateful to Klarsky, because Klarsky kept me from what they used to call it. What did they call it? In the middle of the night. Oh, a blanket party. In the middle of the night, if the troops around you didn't like what you were doing, they would cover you with a blanket and beat the crap out of you. And now Klarsky said he came to me before I went to sleep one night, because I was the platoon leader, and everybody was not happy that we were going on a forced march. I think we were going on a 10-mile forced march. And they were going to give me a blanket party, and Klarsky came and told me that they were going to give me one. And so he said he'd stay up with me. And a couple other guys stayed up with me, and when the guys came in to give me a blanket party, a scrimmage occurred. And there wasn't any really serious injuries or stuff, but I avoided getting my brains beat in. I think all of my fellow veterans have gone through things like that, so I won't bore you too much on that. But we will play this. It's the title of it is A Magnificent Storyteller, Soldier Speaks. And we'll see how, you know, if you enjoy it. It may bring some clarity to you about what was going on. One of the things that really grabbed my heart yesterday was that that the lady who called in and her son had been shot in Vietnam. She even pointed out that he was shot in the back. She wanted to make sure that we talked about that sort of thing, honoring the Vietnam era vets and the Vietnam vets and the, you know, all the vets for their service. And I agree that we needed to talk about that sort of thing, and we will continue today to talk about that. We will talk about it both hours, and then even when we go into Swap Shop at 12:15, I have several trivia, I guess you'd call them trivia, but they're military facts that are quite interesting about how much money was spent on this and how much time was spent on that and that sort of thing. I think you'll find it interesting. It's not political at all. It's just stating facts, right? Well, nowadays, stating facts could be political. We're never quite sure what a fact is anymore with so many people telling you different facts, facts or non-facts. But we will do that. I'm also going to sprinkle those into the next hour and a half. So you get more of an idea of how big our military is. You know, our military budget is bigger than the next, I think, 45 countries combined. We have a huge military budget, and I guess it's kept the world more peaceful since World War II. I know I'm not a big fan of money in politics, but I do think that we have to pay for our government services, and one of them is defense. And I would say that probably if you would ask both Republican and Democratic members of Congress, what is the most significant thing that we do in the Congress, it would be to pass the military budget. That's one of the priorities that our government really has had right from the beginning. Paying George Washington's troops was always important. Anyway, I think I'm going to run over, and we'll do this if I can get it going. We'll do this speech. You can listen to it. I forgot to bring something. Hang on one second. Well, I'm going to makeshift here, I think. I'm struggling, so please hang with me. All right. Now, again, this is a Vietnam era, Vietnam, I believe it's a Vietnam soldier tells a story. And it will tell you right off the bat who it's from. And we've got to get through all the ads first. As you know, if you have been on YouTube, you know you're going to get ads that start with. Okay, it says I can skip the ads here. All right, here we go.
I literally expected to be welcomed with open arms by the people of Vietnam. I had in my head the black and white newsreels I had seen on the Walter Cronkite 20th Century show of the American troops rolling through villages in France and being showered with wine and flowers and kisses. And as we were driving down, a guy from the battalion I was assigned to picked me up in a Jeep at Da Nang, and we had to drive the 20 miles to where my battalion was located. And I really was disappointed that there weren't people standing along the road waving to me and, you know, offering me flowers and things. I really expected to be greeted as with open arms as a liberator, and it was as though I was invisible. It was as though I didn't exist. And that was a little perplexing. Moreover, they looked funny, and they acted funny. I mean, just riding along in this Jeep the first day I got there. They lived in little straw huts, and they had animals in their backyards, and they weren't like us. They smelled bad. The whole country smelled bad. You could smell it. It hurt the nose. And that was disturbing. And then I was there on the third day I was there, this guy who had picked me up in the Jeep, a corporal who I was ultimately going to replace, he and I were in the battalion intelligence section. We were sent down to the tractor park, the amphibious tractor park, to meet a bunch of detainees. It was our responsibility to take care of prisoners, and detainees were a classification of civilians. They were not combatants. They could be detained for questioning, which is why they were called detainees. And Jimmy and I went down there to the track park, and two tractors came in. They had a whole bunch of Vietnamese up on top. High, flat-topped vehicles, about 8 or 9 feet tall. And as the tracks wheeled into the park, the Marines up on top immediately began hurling these people off. They were bound hand and foot, so that they had no way of breaking their falls. And they were old men, women, children, no young men. And I couldn't believe these guys were treating these people this way. And I turned to Jimmy and said, I grabbed him by the arm and said, what are those guys doing? We're supposed to be helping these people. And Jimmy turned to me and he looked at my hands on his arm, sort of took them off, and he said, Earhart, you better keep your mouth shut until you know what's going on around here. And I think it was at that point that I realized things were not quite what I was expecting. It went downhill from there. And again, I can't even begin to explain in the space of time that you have all of the things that went into it, but I began to understand. It became obvious that the enemy was the very people in these villages around us, and we were in a very heavily populated area at that time. They were the enemy, or at least the enemy was out there somewhere, and we couldn't tell one from another. And day after day, our patrols went out. And we ran into snipers and mines, and snipers and mines, and snipers and mines. I saw 4 armed enemy soldiers the first 8 months I was in Vietnam. And yet our battalion, during that same period of time, sustained 75 mining and sniping incidents per month, over half of them resulting in casualties. This is for a unit of about 1,000 men. But there was no one to fight back at. And you begin to think, these people are the enemy. They're all the enemy. And then you go through villages and, you know, you get sniped at, and so you call an airstrike in on the village and the whole village goes up. Or you go through a place and you search it and you burn houses, blow them up. You know, the common perception, the notion I had when I was in high school was that the Viet Cong terrorized the Vietnamese population, forced them to fight against the Americans on the pain of death. What I began to understand in Vietnam was that they didn't need to do things like that. All they had to do was let a Marine patrol go through a village. And whatever was left of that village, they had all the recruits that they needed. I began to understand why the Vietnamese didn't greet me with open arms, why they in fact hated me. But of course that didn't change the fact that my children, no young men, and I couldn't believe these guys were treating these people this way. And I turned to Jimmy and said, I grabbed him by the arm and said, what are those guys doing? We're supposed to be helping these people. And Jimmy turned to me and he looked at my hands on his arm. I sort of took them off and he said, Earhart, you better keep your mouth shut until you know what's going on around here. And I think it was at that point that I realized things were not quite what I was expecting. It went downhill from there. And again, I can't even begin to explain in the space of time that you have all of the things that went into it. But I began to understand, it became obvious that the enemy was the very people in these villages around us, and we were in a very heavily populated area at that time. They were the enemy, or at least the enemy was out there somewhere, and we couldn't tell one from another. And day after day, our patrols went out, and we ran into snipers and mines, and snipers and mines, and snipers and mines. I saw four armed enemy soldiers the first 8 months I was in Vietnam. And yet our battalion during that same period of time sustained 75 mining and sniping incidents per month, over half of them resulting in casualties. This is for a unit of about 1,000 men. But there was no one to fight back at. And you begin to think, these people are the enemy. They're all the enemy. And then you go through villages and, you know, you get sniped at, and so you call an airstrike in on the village and the whole village goes up. Or you go through a place and you search it and you burn houses and blow them up. You know, the common perception, the notion I had when I was in high school was that the Viet Cong terrorized the Vietnamese population, forced them to fight against the Americans on the pain of death. What I began to understand in Vietnam was that they didn't need to do things like that. All they had to do was let a Marine patrol go through a village. And whatever was left of that village, they had all the recruits that they needed. I began to understand why the Vietnamese didn't greet me with open arms, why they in fact hated me. But of course that didn't change the fact that my friends were getting killed and injured every day, and the only place that you could focus your own anger and fear was on those civilians who were there. So it was this self-perpetuating mechanism. The longer that we stayed in Vietnam, the more Viet Cong there were, because we created them, we produced them. None of that distilled itself into the clear kind of expression that I'm presenting now. What I began to understand within days, and which became patently clear within months, was that what was going on here was not what I'd been told. What was going on here was nuts, and I wanted to get out. I knew if I were still alive on March the 5th, 1968, they'd stick me on an airplane in Da Nang. We used to call it the Freedom Bird, and I could fly away and forget the whole thing. Turned out not to be quite so easy to forget it, but that was the notion. And certainly for my last 8-9 months in Vietnam, I ceased to think. I quite literally ceased to think about why I was there or what I was doing. The sole purpose for my being in Vietnam at that point was to stay alive until I could get out.
This cheap American drone destroyed the billion-dollar drone.
Well, now that's quite an interesting discussion. We'll get back to it. I just... They always jump in with a commercial, so I'm breaking in, so you don't have to listen to the commercial. But I remember a lot of young men talking to me about that sort of thing when they came back. Okay, let's go back.
Themselves were ugly, and I didn't want to know the answers. It's like banging on a door. You knock on a door, and the door opens slightly, and behind that door, it's dark, and there's loud noises coming, like there's wild animals in there or something. And you peer into the darkness, and you can't see what's there, but you can hear all this ugly stuff. You want to step into that room? No way. You just sort of back out quietly, pull the door shut behind you, and walk away from it. And that's what was going on. The questions themselves were too ugly to even ask, let alone try to deal with the answers. Now, part of what was going on is that I could not have made sense of what I was seeing and doing in Vietnam because I did not have a full deck of cards. I needed to have an understanding of the political and historical realities that brought us to Vietnam before I could make sense of what I was seeing. I began to acquire the other cards in the deck during the 3 years or so after I got back from Vietnam. But while I was there, nothing made sense because I kept trying to, you know, play this game with 27 cards instead of 52 cards, and it kept not coming out right. And I didn't know why. All I knew was that it was nuts. I mean, it became clear within 3 or 4 months that my reasons for being in Vietnam were not clear. I mean, this notion of defending the people against these invaders from North Vietnam, the people hated me. The Vietnamese people hated me. And it was perfectly clear. I mean, people didn't say good morning to you. People didn't. I mean, people hated me. I know that other people's experience, some other people's experience, was different. But in my own experience, the Vietnamese people hated me, and I gave them every reason to hate me. I beat them. I sometimes killed them. I destroyed their houses. I destroyed their crops. I destroyed their fields. I destroyed their culture. Why in the hell should those people like me? And I could see that I was doing that. And I could see that nothing we were doing was having any impact on the war itself. You know, the funny thing about Vietnam is that I was getting Time magazine every week. It came in the mail. I could read about my war even as I sat in the middle of it. And I would read about what Lyndon Johnson would say and what McNamara would say and what Rusk would say. And I could look around and see that, I don't know what war they're talking about, but that's not what's going on here. We actually had an incident happen where one of our line companies stumbled upon a fairly large cache of Viet Cong weapons and ammunition. And I read in the Stars and Stripes, the daily newspaper that we received, this little action actually made it into the papers, and we read that we had set the Viet Cong effort back by at least 4 months in our area. Within a week of that article appearing in the paper, within 10 days of the incident itself, the bridge 150 meters in front of our battalion compound was dropped by Viet Cong sappers. An Amtrak coming in from the horseshoe area from one of the line companies hit a 50-pound box mine. Several men were killed. A bunch more were wounded. A patrol out at Phuc Troc Bridge was ambushed. Several people were killed. Several people were wounded. I mean, nobody told the Viet Cong that they'd been set back for 4 months. And yet this is what you're reading in the newspapers. This is what you're being told back in the United States. I could see that the war went on day after day after day, interminably, at the same pace, no matter what we did. I'm wasting your film. When I left Vietnam, I was in the midst of the battle for Way City during Tet, 1968, it was February 68, and I'd been up in the city for 2.5-3 weeks, and I knew that my day was coming, but I wasn't sure when, and at that point, we weren't thinking about things like that. And we were in the middle of a low-key firefight. We were exchanging fire with some guys across the street from us out along the eastern, the northeast section of Hue City. What was left of my unit, the scouts, about six of us. And a Jeep comes hauling up the street along the river and whips into this little compound where we were and says, "Earhart, your orders are in. Let's go." It's the lieutenant, my boss, and I stood, well, I didn't exactly stand up, but I immediately began to strip off my gear and distribute it to the other guys who were there and said, "So long, see you back in the world." Got on a Jeep. Last thing I saw, those guys, they were laying down covering fire for us. We burned our way back down the street. There was a chopper sitting on the LZ. I got on a bird. Was up 3,000 feet above Way City 10 minutes after.
Kind of a heart-wrenching story, and we will get back to it here and finish up. So you can hear the rest of it.
Went through some processing. I ended up, they yanked me out early because one of my older brothers by this time had arrived in Vietnam, and they arranged for me to spend a couple of days with him. And I got back, in early March, came in at night, went through more processing. Place called Treasure Island in San Francisco Bay, and then I was free to go. And I was still at time of the Marines. I had a month's leave basically before I had to report to another duty station in North Carolina. And I got a taxi, and there I was, my first view of the United States. And I could hardly wait. And it was absolute impenetrable fog. We came across the Oakland Bay Bridge. Couldn't see 10 feet. Couldn't see anything. Got to the airport. There was part of what affected my coming back. I was happy to be alive. I was excited, but at the same time, I was very ambivalent. I was afraid, partly because I had a girlfriend when I went over there. And in September, 8 months after I was there, I got a Dear John letter from her, and I kept hoping that I'd be able to fix this up once I got back. And I did not know what kind of, and that woman, that girl, had become the focus of my life while I was in Vietnam. She had ceased to be a real person. She'd become this icon. And then, of course, she had sort of, you know, said, "Take a hike." And but you can't just let go of a vision like that, of the thing that has kept you going. So I was scared about all of that. I didn't know what I was going to find when I got back, finally got back to the East Coast.
Well, that's the story. And he was very, not graphic, but he explained what he faced. And I heard lots of stories from my friends who were in country, as they called it, in Vietnam, that sounded very similar to his stories there. I'm sorry for a few of the glitches that we had in there, but I thought it was a a remarkable interview, and I thought maybe you, especially those of you who were in Vietnam, maybe you remember, maybe that'll make you think back about how lucky you were to come home. There were, 60-some thousand killed in Vietnam, and that's just the Americans. It was a great interview, and that's why I thought maybe it would enlighten those of you who were not vets. Now, I understand that there are only 7% of the American public are veterans, and 1% of the American public are currently in the service. So that gives you 8% have a little closer knowledge to where that young man, and he was young when the interview was done, where that young man was coming from. If you listen to the folks this morning, we were all a little bit frightened. I was lucky enough. I got my orders were cut before I even got out of basic training. My orders came, and as a matter of fact, on my way to basic training, I got my orders, and I was able to copy them before I even went to basic training. So I wasn't nearly as terrified as some of the young men that I spent 9 weeks with in basic training. And if you remember basic training, it was kind of terrifying too. Even though I knew I wasn't going to end up in Vietnam, learning how to kill a guy 8 ways with a bayonet, crawling under barbed wire with snakes. There were snakes on our on the field where we had to crawl under the barbed wire. Having live ammunition shot over the top of us. It all awakened your senses. And I am forever happy that I went through it, but also a little bit surprised that I made it. Therefore, most mornings while I'm getting ready, I listen to songs that came out in the 60s. Many of them advocating love your brother. And we'll talk about a little bit more about that in the next hour. You're listening to WWGH here in Marion, Ohio, and we'll be back after about 15-minute break, all right? Thanks for listening. Come back, please.
You're listening to WWGH Radio 107.1 FM LP, Marion, Ohio, the place to talk. Bob McGrath from Sesame Street.
Oh, who are the people in your neighborhood? In your neighborhood, in your neighborhood. Say, who are the people in your neighborhood? The people that you meet when you're walking down the street. The people that you meet each day.
Legendary newsman Hugh Downs. Did you ever think you would be referring to the NBC News anchor as doing something this stupid?
No, I never did think I would. I didn't think that could happen because, first of all, I think the way NBC itself has handled this is really not as smart as it could be. It could be they got to quit using words like mistake and error and start saying what the truth is. That's what they're trying to get out. If they do that, they could get some public restoration of their credibility and help themselves a lot, but they're not doing that. They're still willing to call it a mistake, and that's dumb. It is dumb.
Legendary actor from Barney Miller, Abe Vigoda.
I'm gonna be 94 years old. I'm gonna be 94 years old. I'm so grateful to God.
And from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, Mr. McFeely.
If there's anything you want, if there's anything you need, McFeely's Delivery brings it to you here with speed. Yes, our speedy delivery is a speedy delivery. Speedy delivery to you, Scott.
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, Marion, Ohio. The Talking Place. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Programming on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM is supported by CRT Mechanicals. Address 2842 Marion Waldo Road. Telephone number 740-225-4495. Webpage crtmechanicals.com.
Hey everybody, it's Pastor Steve Whitaker from the Pastor Spot. We are on every Tuesday at 5:15 and replay again on Wednesday at 3:15. We take pertinent issues of the day going on and look at them in a biblical perspective. So we'd love to have you listen and just, you know, call in, just get a conversation going and have a great time on the show.
Pastor Steve Whitaker is the pastor at Community Christian Fellowship in Prospect, Ohio. Address 209 East Water Street. The Marion Towers Apartments are a supporter of WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Address 400 Delaware Avenue. Phone number 740-387-9050. Programs on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are brought to you by Williams Grass Cutters. Telephone number 740-272-0062. Website williamsgrasscutters.com. Facebook page at Williams Grass Cutters. Email w.grasscutters@gmail.com.
Opiates has taken everything and everyone I've ever loved away from me. Everything.
I blew my ankle out and I got prescribed pain pills by my doctor.
If making my detox public is going to help somebody, I'm all for it. I just wish I would have had a warning.
Opioid dependence can happen after just 5 days. Know the truth. Spread the truth. A message from Truth, the Ad Council, and ONDCP.
Adam the Computer Guy is a proud supporter of WWGH Radio, providing on-site and remote-based technical support, computer troubleshooting, and network setup for homes and businesses. Website pctech.biz or adamthecomputerguy.com. Telephone number 740-531-2326. Also available, mobile notary services anywhere in Mid or Central Ohio.
We here at WWGH Radio 107.1 FM are proud to present Magnificent Marion Moments. Florence Mabel Harding was the First Lady of the United States from 1921 to 1923 as the wife of President Warren G. Harding. Known as the Duchess, she adapted well to the White House, where she gave notably elegant parties. She was the first First Lady to vote, operate a movie camera, own a radio, hold her own press conferences, and invite movie stars to the White House.
I'm the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams, and you're listening to WWGH 107.1 FM. I don't want to grow up, but if I did, I still would be a Toys for Us kid.
This is Scott Spears looking down on the beautiful city of Marion from the WWGH News Chopper. If you would like to ever submit a news tip or an event to the WWGH News Department, email Scott at WWGH1071.com and watch out for the chopper. And now a few words from Scott Spears, Charlie Evers, and the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams.
Hey, Scott, I bet you cannot guess what my favorite type of animal is.
Cats?
No, dogs. Now can you guess what my favorite type of dog is?
Black Lab.
No, Golden Retriever. Was there any doubt?
WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, The Talking Place.
tune in to WWGH 107.1 FM on Wednesday at 12:15 p.m. for A Progressive Life with Glenn Coble and the station's presidential expert, Dr. Ronald Fineman. We'll be talking about politics in a civil way, and if you don't like us, you can always turn us off.
Hello, neighbors. This is pastor and Bible teacher Craig Heilman, inviting you to join me this Sunday and every Sunday from 11:10 a.m. to 12 noon for Study His Word Radio. And that's exactly what we do. We'll take a few moments, open up God's Word, and study it. We'll also spend some time talking about current events that relate to the church. We'll have some interviews with local people of faith. We'll answer your Bible questions. And we'll take your comments about our study. So please, join me this Sunday, every Sunday, at 11:10 a.m. right here on WWGH 107.1.
It's now time for WWGH News. News about people, places, and plans. Brought to you live from the WWGH Newsroom.
This is Scott Spears in the WWGH News Center. The Ohio State Highway Patrol Mansfield Post is investigating a two-vehicle fatal crash that occurred on November 8th at 2:24 p.m. The crash occurred on I-71 northbound at milepost 159 in Perry Township, Richland County. The crash occurred when James Covrette, age 65, of Delaware, was outside of his vehicle changing a tire on the disabled horse trailer he was hauling. Also traveling with Mr. Covrette was Lisa Coder, age 39, also of Delaware. While Mr. Covrette was changing the tire, a 2006 red Peterbilt semi driven by Paulo DeSalva, age 67, of Newark, New Jersey, traveled off the right side of the road, striking the horse trailer and Mr. Covrette. The semi continued across all three lanes of travel before coming to rest in the median. Mr. Covrette was pronounced dead at the scene by the Richland County coroner. Mr. DeSalva sustained no injuries as a result of the crash. Ms. Coder was outside of the vehicle at the time of the crash, but sustained no injuries. Three horses occupied the trailer, but sustained no injuries from the crash as well. The crash remains under investigation at this time. The Ohio State Highway Patrol is investigating a single-vehicle fatal crash that occurred on November 10th at approximately 4 p.m. on West Water Street between Lawrence Street and Fulton Street in the city of Sandusky, Erie County. Unit 1, Cesar Avalon, age 45, of Huron, Ohio, was operating a 2015 ASVE Cobra replica car. Mr. Avalon sustained serious injuries in the crash and was pronounced deceased at Firelands Regional Medical Center in Sandusky. Mr. Avalon was not wearing his seatbelt at the time of the crash. Passenger of Unit 1, Ariel D. Palmer, age 29, of Sandusky, was the right front passenger in Unit 1. Ms. Palmer sustained serious injuries and was transported by ground to Firelands Regional Medical Center in Sandusky. She was then transported by Life Flight to Cleveland Metro Health Medical Center. Ms. Palmer was wearing a lap belt. Unit 1 entered West Water Street eastbound from West Shoreline Drive. Unit 1 failed to maintain control and went left of center before crossing back into the eastbound lane. Unit 1 drove off the right side of the roadway and struck a utility pole. Alcohol and/or drug use are not believed to be a factor at this time. The crash remains under investigation.
Another warm day is on the way, with the big cool down coming soon, as well as our first viewing of snowflakes here in the Mid-Ohio area. From the WWGH Weather Center, breezy today, winds gusting as high as 45 miles per hour in the afternoon, with a virtually 100% chance of rain. High of 65. Tonight, more rain, cooling down quite a bit, with a low of 41. Winds gusting between 15 and 30 miles per hour. Partly cloudy on Friday, seasonable high of 54, with southwest winds gusting 20 to 30 miles per hour. Friday night, rain showers possible, with a low of 35. A preview of winter for Saturday, mostly cloudy, 42. on Sunday. 50% chance we will see the first snowflakes of fall 2021, and a high only of around 40. Cooler weather will also continue for the early part of next week. The talk.